Hi, you're listening to the International Risk Podcast. This podcast is for CEOs, board members, risk and compliance officers, security advisors, and anyone interested in improving operations. On this podcast, we hear from the traditional to the wacky, from renowned risk management experts to Red Bull daredevils. There is something to learn about the way we perceive, manage, and mitigate risk from all of our guests. Your host, Dominic Bowen, will ask the questions that you all want the answers to. If you know Dominic, then you know he is well acquainted with risk. His 20-year career has seen him successfully establish operations in some of the most complex environments around the world. Dominic has spent most of his career establishing large and successful operations in places like Haiti, Syria, Sudan, Iraq, Lebanon, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and so many other high-risk and medium-risk locations. Joined by our excellent guests, he'll reveal innovative ideas on how you can ensure your organisation thrives in areas with high risk.
Hi, I'm Dominic, host of the International Risk Podcast. Parliamentary elections were held in Serbia in mid-December 2023, and today we're joined by Alexandra Masarovic, who earned his PhD in politics at the University of Edinburgh, to discuss recent events in Serbia. His thesis when he was doing his PhD analysed the impact of informal political networks on the European Union and the accession processes of Slovenia, Croatia, and Serbia. Since he finished his PhD, Alexander's been a teaching assistant at the University of Edinburgh, the University of Stirling, and he's also worked as a lecturer in politics at the University of Strathclyde. He's previously been on the International Risk Podcast discussing the international risks associated with European Union enlargement in the Balkans, and you can listen to that conversation at episode 141. But today, we have Alexander here to discuss the parliamentary elections in Serbia. Welcome back onto the International Risk Podcast today.
Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, always a pleasure to be here, and hopefully I can share some useful information about the Balkans and specifically the elections in Serbia with the listeners.
Fantastic. Thanks, Alexandra. There's been a lot of controversy surrounding these elections and the president's victory in them. For the benefit of our listeners, can you provide some context about these elections, how they came about, why they came about so early, what they mean for Serbia, and perhaps what they mean for the Balkans and even Europe at large?
Of course, these elections were called early in response to protests against the president, Aleksandar Vučić, and his government after two actually mass shootings in Serbia, which took place in the spring and summer, which were big public tragedies. There was a big outpouring of anger against the regime and particularly against the particular way that people and society and religion or ethnicities are portrayed in a lot of news, portrayed in sort of public relations and in the media in general. So in response to this, people took to the streets to protest against the regime and demand changes to media regulations, demand changes to the system, changes to society in general. So in response to these protests, Vučić decided to call their protesters' bluff by calling early elections. And so elections were scheduled for December 17th and went ahead as scheduled. This is not the first time that Vučić has called early elections. Most governments in Serbia, the last 15 years or so, have failed to complete their mandate as per the normal cycle. Governments, especially under Vučić, who's been in power now since 2012, have tended to end early due to various political gambles or to resolve various crises or simply attempt to outflank the anti-Vučić opposition, if you will.
Now, in Australia, for example, you know, there's a normal election cycle, but the incumbent party can call elections early, but usually they will only do that if they're ahead in the opinion polls and they suspect they could go down before their term ends. But to call an election when there is wide-scale protests against you seems like a strange move. Can you unpack that for us as to why you'd call elections when you're unpopular?
Well, it has to do with the difference between politics in a country like Australia and politics in a country like Serbia. In Serbia, the ruling party, Serbian Progressive Party, ironically named, has built up a very large clientelist machine. Right. So if you think of elections, perhaps in Australia or Canada or the US, France, you know, the UK, politicians will go to the polls. Right. There's a brief election window. They propose programs or platform manifestos. Right. They have debates and the voters tend to make the decisions based on that. Right. There's always other factors involved in these decisions. It's not just about the policies, as we all know. But this isn't necessarily the case in Serbia. Serbia, like a lot of other countries that have what's called hybrid regimes, right, or sort of semi-authoritarian regimes or competitive authoritarian regimes, depending on which professor you're talking to, which classification system you want to use. The political parties in these countries tend to have a lot more direct contact with voters, and by that I mean there tends to be a lot more corruption. So, for example, the Progressive Party in Serbia has built a vast network of party patronage, you know, where you have the president on top, you've got party officials, members of the parliament, and this stretches then down even into local council districts, right? And these people are responsible for getting out the vote in their district, for ensuring that all their family and friends and things vote for the party, and even people working for state enterprises. Political appointees to state-run companies will be responsible for ensuring that everyone in their office shows up to vote for the party, right, at whatever election is called. This is then, of course, matched with perhaps less than clear and above-board election practices. Moments of, for example, people taking pictures of their ballots, right, so they can then show to the party official that they have voted for the party. And it's a two-way street. It's not solely a sort of top-down form of control. There's quite a lot of good research been done on why people engage at the bottom level up, clientless practices. But for example, if you need a job and someone says, if you vote for me, I'll get you a job, that's a pretty tempting offer, right? And the Progressive Party has been really, really good at mobilizing that machine and then also mobilizing all the state resources associated, right, with their now long-term control of the Serbian government. So either Vučić himself or the political party or people associated with the party tend to also control major media channels, right? All the main TV channels. There were massive protests specifically against this channel called Pink, which was considered one of the biggest promoters of violent content and violent media in advance of the two unfortunate mass shootings. And so all of these resources can be mobilized by the party. And so there's a mixture of that clientelism, plus it's also political calculation. So the Progressive Party is a big tent populist party, right? They have some ideas, but they're pro-EU officially, but also pro-Russia. You know, they support anti-corruption measures. They support some environmental stuff. They support the Orthodox Church, but they're also not particularly openly anti-women's rights. I mean, this is how they generally would classify themselves. But so the problem by positioning themselves in this sort of mixed, weird, centrist-ish political spectrum is it means the opposition's had a hard time unifying against them, right? How do you bring together people who would be anti-Vučić, right, from the far right with people from the far left? Will the pro-EU political parties, the smaller ones that have now managed to win elections for several cycles now, can they cooperate with people who are on the strong pro-Russian faction, right, who just don't like the corruption of the regime? Well, it's very difficult. And so by calling these elections early, Vučić often manages to sort of wrong foot the opposition by preventing them from coalescing around a real sort of alternative leader.
And so what do the election results and the protests mean for the political landscape and the power distribution within Serbia today?
So, unfortunately, the results mean that Vučić did it again. After these two mass shootings and out of those street protests, there was the rise of what's called the Serbia Against Violence Coalition, which is a bunch of sort of activists from the streets, also allying then with existing political parties or parliamentarians who defected from pre-existing political parties to come together to form a coalition for basically the reform of Serbia, right? Saying that the coalition against violence, they're against the sort of ethnic-based violence perpetuated by the regime, right? There was also the unfortunate incident of members of the Serbian state security services assaulted a monastery in Kosovo and engaged in a shootout with the Kosovar police back over the summer as well. They weren't officially controlled by the regime. I guess they did it on their own time, but that was a particularly dangerous spark onto the kindling of the existing fault lines in the region. So the Serbia Against Violence Coalition is against that, right? But they didn't really manage to pull off a mass election victory. They did okay. They are the largest opposition bloc in the parliament. And they were hopeful that they were going to win Belgrade, take control of the city council in Belgrade, and then also the mayoralty of Belgrade, which is the capital of Serbia. But they didn't manage to win this. They say that they did. And so actually several members of the party were on hunger strike for several days after the election. There were allegations of vote rigging, of vote buying. There was the incident where in the Stark Arena, which is one of the big sports arenas in Belgrade, where busloads of people were seen arriving before being distributed to other polling booths around Belgrade. Now, the Prime Minister of Serbia says that that's fine. You are legally allowed to bus people. You're allowed to assist people in voting in Serbia. The Prime Minister said that's all fine. And the opposition so says that these are all people from Bosnia who've been bused in to cast ballots in Belgrade so that they could ensure that the Progressive Party has a win in the city chambers and maintains control of Belgrade. So unfortunately, Vučić did it again. Not well, not necessarily legally, but he's managed to maintain control.
And the family of a Serbian opposition leader who was allegedly beaten up while in detention and being detained by the country's Secret Service say he's been left partly paralysed by the attack. Now, not surprisingly, this assault has fueled even more fears about the future of democracy in Serbia on top of the allegations that you spoke about that have been published quite widely in the media. And the family say he was arrested on the 3rd of January. After he made an apology for crimes committed by Serbs against ethnic Albanians during the Kosovo War and independence in 1998 and 1999. So the family got to visit him a few days later. I think it was about 5 days after he was taken into custody. And apparently he's partly paralyzed on one side. He's in a wheelchair and in really bad condition. Now, there are several concerns around this, including the apparent breach of the European Convention on Human Rights, which is meant to protect political speech. Apparently there's been a case filed with the UN Committee Against Torture. What does the elections and I guess events over the last month, including activities like this, mean for opposition groups in Serbia?
Well, so one particularly fun detail you left out, fun is the wrong word, of that whole story is he's also stuck in a military hospital, which is not an unusual thing. The Serbian military hospital, particularly the one in Belgrade, tends to be one of the better ones, you know, legacy of socialism. But he's also been tried for inciting racial violence and ethnic hatred, and so is currently being prosecuted after having been assaulted. From what we see from this and from the tricks that the regime has used, we see that they've managed to develop their tools of electoral oppression, rather electoral subversion and political oppression over the last 15 years. There are those who say that this perhaps is a sign the regime is scared, right? In prior elections, there was no need for this kind of thing because it was sort of more generically popular, right? But I don't necessarily buy that argument, right? I personally think this is probably a sign the regime is getting just more confident because Vucic has really mastered the playing both sides approach, right? When after the elections, right, while the opposition was crying foul and the OSCE was producing their report decrying the state of the elections, the U.S. ambassador put out a lovely video congratulating Vucic on his victory and stating that he was looking forward to working with Vucic to further stabilize the region and produce growth and all these sort of things. In response to this, Vucic decreed that now Serbia will recognize license plates with the Kosovar state emblem on them. And this license plate dispute had been a dispute for years, causing mass protests and things. And so by doing that, Vucic continues to play both sides. And this presents a problem for the opposition, because then which side do they go to? Will the West drop supporting Vucic entirely to support, you know, calls for truly free and fair elections? Probably not. So, okay, right, well, they're not going to go to Russia to try and get free and fair elections, are they? And this is a political problem they've had to confront now for several election cycles. In terms of tactics that the opposition has picked up on, I am actually a little hopeful in this, because we saw really a lot of unity around the Serbia Against Violence coalition. One of the, well, okay, depressing for them, but one of the, what I would argue is upsides from the election is actually that several older political names and their political parties pretty much failed to get support. For example, this other politician, Vuk Jeremic, who, you know, from, I've met him at a conference before, an event, he's a very nice guy on a personal basis, but he's been trying to be president now for 20 years, and it never really works. And all it's achieved in the previous electoral cycles is to scrape off a couple, 2 to 3 or 5% of the vote from the opposition, right, to keep splitting that vote. And it's not just Jeremic, right? Boris Tadic, who used to be president of Serbia back in 2008 to 2012, his, you know, now fourth revamp party also failed to gain any seats in the parliament, right? I'm not saying that he's a bad guy. I mean, I think what he did in 2008 to 12 was pretty good in terms of how we've seen the future trajectory of Serbia go. But there's been a sort of winnowing down of the opposition members, right, possible opposition candidates, to a core around the Serbia Against Violence coalition. And I think that's a pretty useful change.
It's interesting you mentioned the difficult political dynamic and where opposition groups could be going to for support. The Russian ambassador to Serbia was being briefed by Vucic, and they both agreed that the protests were organized by the West. And at the same time, the US ambassador to Serbia, Christopher Hill, also condemned the protests, saying violence and vandalism were against state institutions and have no place in a democratic society, despite the widespread recognition that the votes were rigged. Now, when Serbia was ruled by Slobodan Milosevic, the West, including the United States, strongly supported democratic change in the country. But now, as Serbia seems to be, or potentially, backsliding towards autocracy under Vucic, this commitment from the United States seems to have disappeared. So I'm trying to work out, is the West too scared to condemn Serbia for fear of pushing them further into the grip of Russia? Or is there something else at play here?
So I think it's certainly both, right? The biggest factor for me, and this hurts as someone whose family's from the region, right? It hurts me to say, is that Serbia's just not that important. I mean, would the US or the West invest, you know, let's say 10 years of broken relations and possible surges of violence for a country of less than 7 million people? I mean, is it really that important? Would the US, you know, drop everything to really force this issue through? Probably not, right? But there's also, besides me just being the depressed Eastern European, woe upon me and my people, there's also a tactical reason for this, right? The West is so overwhelmed at the moment, maybe not overwhelmed, but is beset by various crises, right? It's been this way for quite a while, right? You think back to, you know, the 2015 migration crisis in Europe, right? After the Eurozone financial crisis and the US financial crisis, the West just doesn't have the same swagger or power that it used to, right? To try and confront multiple challenges. And Vucic has been great for a while at playing these issues off each other. You know, as much as the US would prefer if Serbia was a fully functional liberal democracy, right, you know, sort of a Switzerland in the Balkans or something, they'll probably take it as it is, which has made Serbia the only country in the region not to join with the sanctions packages against Russia. But at the same time, Serbia is also selling arms to Ukraine, right? And this is particularly useful given that a lot of the arms produced in Serbia, right, are of the same caliber munitions, right, that can be used by a lot of the Ukrainian old Soviet era equipment, which are munitions that the US or Western Europe doesn't produce, right? They're not NATO caliber. And so that's a very useful sort of way that Serbia under Vucic has been able to contribute to that front on that end, while also maintaining ties with Russia. Right, Vucic hasn't resolved the Kosovo crisis, right? There's still ethnic tensions, right? It flares up periodically. There's blockades. Randomly, people from the security service might go shoot a couple people. But at the same time, the crises are maintained. They are managed. Whenever there is a problem, if it gets too much, you can always call Vucic and he will get everyone to calm down. Similar in Bosnia as well, right? You know, Vucic now and various members of the party, you know, supported the Republika Srpska Day celebrations in Republika Srpska, the Serbian half of Bosnia, even though the EU, through its representative there, declared that the Republika Srpska celebrations are illegal. It's a commemoration day to commemorate the successful ethnic cleansing that created the Serbian half of the Federation. So that's not great. People are there singing songs to war criminals and things like that, and there's big banners with war criminals on them. That's not great, right? But Vucic now recognized Kosovo license plates. So, you know, little quid pro quo to both sides, right? And because of the fault lines in and around the region still that remain unresolved, right, at a fundamental level, this ability that Vucic has to kind of press on one if he wants and then sort of press the other key is very useful and has sort of frozen the West, right? I think the West could change. EU accession could save the country, right? Everyone likes economic growth. None of these things are impossible. But when the US, if Biden has to choose between confronting Russia over Ukraine, right, confronting China over Taiwan, you know, trying to contain, you know, the war in the Middle East, right, sending, you know, aircraft carriers to deal with the Houthis, dealing with possible issues in Latin America, right, Venezuela maybe invading other countries now, is Serbia going to be at the top of that list? Does anyone want to invest in that particular problem? Not really. And that's the game Vucic has learned to play.
And so you discuss fault lines in the region and you discuss, you know, does anyone want to invest in that when there's clearly bigger conflicts around the world? What are the potential international risks that could arise from the current controversies in Serbia and how might they impact regional stability in the Balkans?
So the potential fault lines here are similar to ones you get with any other sort of hybrid regime, right? As much as Vucic is very much so the man in control, right? That won't always be the case. It won't always be forever. And in semi-authoritarian or authoritarian regimes, the riskiest moment is always at the moment of regime transition. Vucic may have a heart attack tomorrow. You know, that can happen to anybody. It's a tragedy when it does. Some people more than others. And, you know, that may kick off a wider regional conflagration, right? You just don't know. And especially when there are so many other actors involved, these things can spiral out of hand pretty well. You know, as much as we paint most authoritarian states as truly unified singular blocks, I mean, this isn't like the Soviet Union, right? Vucic doesn't have 100% command and control. This isn't World War II in Stalinist Russia, right? That's not really what we're dealing with here. So the interlocking networks of right-wing gangs, football hooligans, criminal gangs, smuggling networks that pervades especially radical right-wing extreme Serbian public space, right, across the region, that could be a real potential flashpoint. Because there are Serbs, you know, in Bosnia, in Montenegro, you know, in North Kosovo, who are unsatisfied with the borders as they're drawn, right? Potentially some in Croatia as well, although that community generally has made great strides to try and overcome that, unlike, for example, the Serbs in Montenegro. But then you get these interlocking then other regional networks. Croatian and Serbian far-right groups socialize with each other and other communities, right? If they're going to a neo-Nazi rally in Hungary, right, you'll get groups from all over the region hanging out and spending time with each other. You know, there's still deep underlying issues of racism and oppression of like the Roma community and things. And you're just never sure when one of these pieces is going to go up. As much as Vucic has control over the official politics of Serbia, can he prevent, let's say, a random right-wing ethnic Serbian mob in northern Bosnia from going on a rampage at some point? And that could be the spark that lights the tinderbox, you know?
So how likely do you think it is that there could be large-scale violence in the region?
I think it's pretty unlikely because it's not in any of the big players' interests. You know, as much as, for example, at the Republika Srpska celebration, there were representatives from the Grey Wolves, which are a Serbian, although also deeply tied in with the Russian organization of sort of radical right-wing biker gang, right? They ride around on Harley Davidsons and fly flags of Putin. And so, yes, these people were there and a lot of them would like violence. But generally, everyone's pretty satisfied as long as you don't rock the boat, right? Like all the criminal gang members get to make their money. You know, everyone kind of passes through. The drugs flow. The illegal cigarettes imported through Montenegro, right, can flood in the region. And as long as no one tries to, you know, stop that trade, then everyone can keep profiting and the wheels can keep spinning. But if there's one thing I've learned from studying the region, I mean, you can never be 100% sure, right? Yugoslavia was a wonderful, happy country until suddenly one day it wasn't and the world fell apart. But maybe that's just my Balkan bias.
Yeah, well, hopefully it is legitimately that way. But considering the opposition critiques regarding media freedom, regarding election fairness, around corruption, what does this mean for business leaders and people looking to invest in Serbia or trade with Serbia or utilize supply chains and companies currently in Serbia?
So Serbia remains, I think, a country that's really blessed as a potential place for investment, right? The current regime, though, I would say makes that a little bit more difficult. It's not turned companies off, right? Microsoft has a very large office there. There's a lot of new tech companies moving in. If you're looking for a country that has good access to the European markets and also the Russian markets, you know, or you're trying to do also trade with Chinese subsidiaries, Serbia is a pretty good place for that. I would, though, recommend some level of caution, especially when dealing with the regime. I mean, I know this tends to be a bigger problem with more local businesses, but I know the business environment can be quite tough, right? You're never quite sure if the bureaucrats you're dealing with are going to be okay, right? You may have to pay some bribes, although Serbia is not the most corrupt country in the world by any stretch of the imagination. But you may have to sort of consider some things when looking for a place to invest, right? It's very well connected in terms of regional networks, right? There's a lot of good transport networks, links flow through there. It's got a slowly building biotech industry because it built production centers for Pfizer, but also the Chinese and Russian vaccines, right? Back during the darker days of COVID. So there's definitely something to it, right? But I would be a little hesitant to deal with the regime. You don't necessarily want to build a large factory there only to find out that either, you know, some gang has taken over the local district and you have to deal with them now.
And so what are the most pressing challenges or priorities for the newly elected government in Serbia, especially considering the current environment you've just described?
So the most pressing challenges for the not necessarily new government, but the refreshed, perhaps, SNS government, will be trying to confront some of the same problems they've been trying to confront for the last 15 years. Supposedly, EU accession is back on the table now with more money and more strength, right? So there may perhaps be a shift by the country, by the government, into a slightly more pro-EU line, right? Sort of keep checking off a couple sort of nice things off the list to make sure the EU money keeps flowing. But the biggest issues, I mean, are going to be the ones that we've been dealing with for 20 years, right? So Kosovo remains on the agenda as a thing to resolve. EU accession is the big sort of policy priority. But there are also more prosaic concerns. The new railway connecting Budapest to Belgrade is either up and running now or should be up and running soon. So that's some progress there, right? But there are environmental concerns. There were big protests against a potential lithium mine in eastern Serbia, as the locals didn't want to deal with, well, they didn't want to deal with Rio Tinto. And so these are things the government's going to have to navigate. Serbia is not the best country in the region, not the worst country in the region for a lot of standard metrics, right? You know, it's dealing with a big population exodus, population shrunk now to below 7 million for the first time since the 50s, I think, or the 60s. So it's no longer necessarily the big leading light of the region in terms of population. But that also doesn't make it stand out from the region. Most of the countries of Central and Eastern Europe have lost quite a lot of population in the last 30 years. And so the government should be trying to tackle these issues. How they will be tackled, though, is another question.
You've described Vučić's ability to very delicately dance on the international stage and manage a variety of geopolitical issues. In the current environment, in the post-election, how will the environment in Serbia affect the European Union's stance on enlargement and Serbia's potential accession?
So a big risk is that Serbia is simply going to get passed by. As much as the EU would love to have Serbia as a member state, right, the Commission, especially von der Leyen, keeps talking about a geopolitical commission. There are great big strategic reasons to bring the whole Western Balkans into the EU. The argument that, well, if everyone's a member state, then none of these ethnic divisions will matter anymore. You can travel wherever, you can move wherever, all the rules and laws are the same. So that would be great. But, I mean, would the EU let in Serbia as a member state now? Probably not. I'm not sure if this is a good thing, but one potential way in which Vučić might avoid this sort of block is the fact that Viktor Orban is going to be chair of the EU Council this year. So, and especially now that Charles Michel has stepped down, there's a chance that Orban may get to just head it himself, right? May actually take over as council president and set the agenda for 6 months, which would be good for Serbia. Would it be good for Europe? That's a subject for a different podcast. But specifically in terms of Serbia's ability to dance this dance, I think that'll be a fun 6 months for Vučić.
And it would be remiss of me not to ask you, noting your expertise, about the role of informal political networks in Serbia, you know, how they compare to neighbouring countries that you've also had a look at, and what you think their main focus is going to be for the next couple of years.
So I think the informal networks in Serbia are just 100% focused on stability. These are networks that have built themselves around sort of accumulating and maintaining power. Vučić's network spread out from himself, right, from his family, you know, his brother is also big in this sort of smuggling. Well, let me not libel him. I don't have any personal evidence of that myself. But, you know, he has allegations that he's been involved in smuggling, while people who are friendly and allied to Vučić have bought out most of Serbia's media landscape. So these networks in Serbia are going to continue to try and perpetuate themselves. In terms of informal networks in the opposition, like I said, I think I'm seeing a little bit more unity now, which is good. Previous attempts at forming a unity coalition often involved 8 men standing up in a row, all talking about how they should be president with their own little small networks of supporters and individuals. This is getting more concentrated. I think that's a good thing. How it compares to other countries? I mean, Montenegro at the moment is undergoing a really interesting shift with the decline of the pyramid of power that was Milo Djukanovic, the on and off prime minister president for 30 years. So with his now departure, right, and the fractious coalitions they've had since, this perhaps produces a window of opportunity, right, for some change and for some real solid reform, right? It's always a difficult one to try and use the informal networks for good if you can. But if Montenegro can make real progress on their reforms, I think they can lock in some solid progress on EU accession, unlock more money, and that can create a sort of virtuous cycle of further reforms, right? Something Slovenia did where there were informal groups who were against accession, but everyone basically agreed we all have to do this and we'll kind of buy off the people who don't want to do it. For example, the particular case there was duty-free shops on the border, which had to be closed, and the owners are very angry. But if you can manage to overcome those groups, a lot of good can be done. And other countries in the region, Bosnia, I think, is going to have some trouble, right? Yeah, under the current high representative from the EU, he's not very popular in the country. He's not managing the crises all that well. There are accusations amongst the heads of the three ethnicities that they're always taking each other's side on things. There were protests against electoral law reforms the last time. And now Milorad Dodik has managed to hold the constitutionally illegal Republika Srpska celebrations against Christian Smith's explicit command not to. The informal networks in Bosnia continue to test the formal limits of power of the system. But yeah, I mean, I speak to people who are very concerned that Bosnia might blow up at any moment. I don't see it immediately about to blow up. For example, you know, if Bosnia was to fall apart and Milorad Dodik was to secede, and then he joins Serbia, and then what, he becomes the governor, the mayor, his current personal position is really good, right? He's the powerful, strong, interesting guy at the head of a secessionist republic, right? With his strong networks of supporters all dedicated to the cause. While if he gets his wish, then he gets to what? Retire to southern Serbia and live in a nice house there. And while Vučić takes over Republika Srpska. So I think as long as those personal power interests are not necessarily aligned with chaos, I think that order will reign.
Well, let's hope order reigns. That sounds like a reasonable spot to pause the podcast before we get into some less optimistic parts of the region. But look, thanks very much for coming back on the podcast today, Alexander.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Excellent. Well, that was another great conversation with Alexander Masarovic, who's clearly an expert in the Balkans and the region and local networks there. Today's podcast was coordinated and produced by Ben Lawson. I'm Dominic Bowen, host of the International Risk Podcast. Thanks very much for listening today, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
You've been listening to the International Risk Podcast hosted by Dominic Bowen. Please go to wherever you download your podcasts and give this podcast a 5-star review. Your positive reviews on this podcast and subscribing to future downloads is critical for our success. If you enjoyed the show, tell a friend about this podcast. Consider if you know someone that would appreciate or benefit from today's conversation and send them this podcast right now. Thank you for listening and join us again next week for your fix of risk-related stories.